That light is really bright. Becky said there's a really strong light shining down here this morning. It's absolutely true. I'd like to make one thing really clear before I start. This is not a sermon that is about to pick on those of you who might consider yourself richer than others. Compared to the world standard, there is not a person sitting in here, there might be one or two exceptions, who is not rich. So let go of that anxiety if you have it. The writings of James have actually suffered over the years. For the book of James was seen as being in direct contrast to Paul's writings, which were about the fact that faith or belief saves. And James was seen as a book that said that faith and works save. Many did not like what they saw as being an inappropriate focus on works. Luther, for example, called this the Epistle of Straw. Now, just to be careful, I looked up straw on Wikipedia, and this is what it said. It's the stalk left after the grain has been removed from the crop. It has little nutritional value and is primarily used as roughage to add to other food. Its main use is as bedding for animals. And if you think about that for a moment, you will be aware of what happens to anything that animals spend much time either lying or standing on. Thus, eventually, it gets shoveled or raked out and added to the manure pile. So that will give you a pretty clear example of what Luther thought of James. James' writing has also suffered because it is looked at as the "do this" book. In its five chapters, it actually has 52 "do this" type of statements. And I know all of us love to be told what to do, don't we? No. So, especially when it's as blunt as James can be. However, I'd like to take us in another direction, which you've probably figured out if you listen to the children's story. And I think that this approach gives the writing of James practical value and help to any generation of churchgoers. Listen to what Eugene Peterson says in his introduction to James. Wisdom is not knowing the truth, although it certainly includes that. It is a skill in living. For what good is the truth if we don't know how to live it? James chapter 2 actually has two helpful examples of what this might look like, that wisdom is actually knowing the truth and living it. And the first one has been read to us, and I will draw our attention to the second one. The first one is about paying more attention to certain kinds of people. And the example that James uses is that of people who look wealthier, who look more put together, and ignoring those who look poorer, who do not look as if they are as wealthy as others. And I must confess that this is very easy to do. I spend Monday to Thursday in the office, and I see different people coming into the office. And I make certain judgments as I see them in the camera in terms of how they are dressed and how they look. Now, neither James nor I are saying that we should be foolish about observing people. This is not about being naive. However, James challenges us to treat people equally. The God we say we follow, if we do, offers love and mercy to all, and wants his followers to show the same generosity of welcome to all. Of course, it's easy to see this when you look at the life of Jesus. And if you haven't done it in a while, read the Gospel of Luke or read another favorite gospel and just ask yourself the simple question, how does Jesus treat people? Well, of course, he hangs around with women and actually has religious conversations with them, which would have been considered particularly inappropriate for the time because they weren't thought to be bright enough to have those conversations. He hangs around with tax collectors, who were particularly unpopular in that culture. He hung around with the poor, with prostitutes. He hung around with the wealthy and partied with them and ate with them. So why should we be surprised when James says exactly the same thing? I love this quote from N.T. Wright. He tells a story that in some of the early churches, when regular attendees arrived, the ushers looked after them. Three cheers for the ushers. But if somebody new came in, particularly if they looked poor, the bishop got up from their chair and went and welcomed them. Now, the second example of this behavior that James calls us to is actually found in verses 15 and 16, and it goes like this. If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you says to them, "Go in peace, keep warm, and eat your fill," and yet do not supply their bodily needs, what good is that? So saying that we follow the one who so clearly states that the poor, the widow, the orphan, the alien, those on the margins, are of great care and concern to God, saying that and not doing anything about it just does not work. What James is, I believe, is a call to action, not just talk. It's a call to practicality, not just discussion. I had the privilege a number of years ago of hearing General Romeo Dallaire speak at a prayer breakfast. And in the midst of the developing massacre in Rwanda, when he was the head of the United Nations forces there, he pled for more help to stop the massacre. And he was told by a diplomat that there was really nothing of value in Rwanda. There weren't diamonds. There weren't valuable minerals. There wasn't oil. The only real thing that Rwanda had was people, and it wasn't worth helping them. So what do we do? How do we act in a world where, among other needs, and there are many in our world, we have, for the last weeks, been seeing refugees climbing through razor wire at borders, battling police at borders, hearing of sunken boats with hundreds drowned in just one capsize. We have spent a week dealing with the wrenching picture of a Turkish soldier picking up the body of a little boy who looked asleep in the gentle waves of a beach. But he is not asleep, he is dead. One picture that perhaps has a chance of galvanizing our world to respond. So I ask myself and I ask us, what action can we take on behalf of God for those on the margins? And I think that one of the things we can do is look back at our history as a country and as a church when we responded well. And we have not always responded well. But when we have responded well, we have done things like welcome thousands after World War II. I learned that the Lutherans, the Mennonites, and the Baptists and other denominations banded together to sponsor thousands of families after the Second World War. That many other non-denominational and non-church people and the government also helped sponsor and bring over displaced people. I read that by the late 1949, that the North American Baptist Church alone had settled 30,000 ethnic-speaking Germans. I've heard Linda Mabbott, who I don't think is here today, talk about the families that her father and mother sponsored on their farm after the war. When the Vietnamese boat people began to flee South Vietnam, our Canadian government said that they would match one-to-one any family that was privately sponsored by sponsoring one through the government. We had 110,000 boat people come just to Canada. We will, as a country, I am sure, take more Syrians than we have even offered to at this point, because there will be so much pressure to do so. I think the offer at this point is somewhere near 40,000. However, it interests me to read that Germany alone believes that it will need to sponsor 800,000 refugees this year alone. I read on a Facebook post from one of our members that in the immediate, there are more than a few very good nonprofits working in that area. Doctors Without Borders, Red Cross, CARE, UNICEF, World Vision, Mennonites, World Relief, and there will be others. Find one you like and give. We can ask questions of people to become better informed. Write your MP and your MLA and ask questions about our policies and why it is so difficult and so time-consuming for people to be brought to this country. Learn about the roadblocks that need to be changed. And yes, lest you think that I think this is simple, it is not. It is complex. It's hugely complex. Accepting huge populations of refugees costs a lot of money. And yes, it changes one's country. And yes, there will be some of them that will be a problem. ISIS is already saying that it has smuggled in thousands of their own people amongst the refugees. And yes, there is no simple answer to the war in that area. The Assad regime, ISIS, Turkish-Kurdish conflict, tribal, national, dictator-driven or religious wars are never clean. War is dirty, destructive, and horrifying. Yet we cannot ignore or escape the call of God to care for the refugee, the alien, the orphan, the widow, the poor, here in our own country and in other parts of our world. We cannot, James reminds us, accept God's mercy for ourselves and not extend it to others. We cannot merely pray for those in need and do nothing. Those of us who say we follow must act. We really have no choice as the Church of Jesus. Remember also that the good news for us is that no matter how much we give, how little or how much, that it all matters. What matters is that we act as well as say we believe. I'm going to give us a moment to reflect in silence, and then I will say amen. Amen.